Tale of Two Kingdoms, Part 26. Well, welcome to all of you who are non-regular participants in the class. You've come at a propitious time. I'm going to kill James off today. And we'll do a little bit of review then. So this may not quite make sense. I need to sort of finish a few details of his the last 4 years of his life, and then I'm going to, kill him off, as it were, and then do a little bit of review of church-state relations under his reign. Okay, so last week we looked at how James got rid of 8 of the more troublesome ministers. This is a regular thing on his part. He basically, flatters some ministers, cajoles, and bribes some that are compliant, and the others he tries to persecute, intimidate, and get rid of. These 8 ministers, and most of them ended up, some ended up overseas, some in England, and some in Scotland, but under severely constrained limits as to where they could go. Okay, after that he pushed through the rest of his reforms in church government, and this created an episcopacy with James at its head. Okay, so he then turned his attention to worship, and in 1618 through 1621 he was able to put through the 5 Articles of Perth, first through the General Assembly, then through the Privy Council, then through Parliament. And those made a series of changes to the official form of worship.
Let me get this right. You talk about King James and King James Bible?
Yes, the same, one and the same.
Christian?
Yes. King James and the King James Bible, persecuting Christians. So I mentioned last week that, among other things, he had created or given commissions to form what are known as courts of high commission. These are courts that are established by the king. They had no other legal basis. They were officially to deal with church discipline, but in fact, they also covered civil matters. Specifically, they included disciplining ministers who spoke out against the established order of the Kirk or against any of the conclusions of the bypassed General Assemblies. That was in 1610. In 1615, it was added that those who spoke out against the present established order of the Kirk or estate, against any of the conclusions of the bypassed General Assembly, holden at Glasgow, Acts of Parliament, especially the Act of Parliament holden at Edinburgh in October 1612. Okay, the assembly referred to was the so-called Angelical Assembly, where episcopacy was firmly established. So these courts were tyrannical. They had none of the usual sort of safeguards against abuse in terms of whether or not witnesses could be forced to testify against themselves and so on. So it was sort of a Scottish Inquisition. Although I think by this time James had pretty much established himself, so perhaps the courts didn't have to go quite as far as they might have otherwise. When these 5 acts of Perth, 5 articles of Perth, and these were articles that established certain Anglican church practices in the Scottish church. They included things like kneeling at communion and private baptism and private communion, catechism with the bishop blessing the children, and various practices that went against the Scottish form of worship. In any case, once these were actually ratified by Parliament in 1621, the Court of High Commission had a new justification to persecute the Presbyterians. And James himself wrote a letter to the Archbishop of St. Andrews, who was Archbishop Spotswood. James wrote this. I guess sometimes the formality was that the Archbishop would write it, send it to James. He would then sign it and send it back. So that it's sort of like I sometimes write reference letters for my students by telling them to write the reference letter, and then I get it. And if it's not a lot of nonsense, I may edit it a little bit and, sign it and send it on. A lot of times it's a lot of nonsense, so I have to do more than that. But in any case, he certainly signed this letter, and it contained the following: the greatest matter the Puritans, and he sort of lumped all the Presbyterians together as the ones that he didn't like as Puritans. The greatest matter the Puritans had to object against the church government was that your proceedings were warranted by no law, which now by this last Parliament is cut in short, so that hereafter that rebellious, disobedient, seditious crew must either obey or resist God, their natural king, and the law of the country. It resteth therefore to you to be encouraged and comforted by this happy occasion, and to lose no more time to procure a settled obedience to God and to us, that's him, by the good endeavors of our commissioner and our other true-hearted subjects and servants. The sword is now put into your hands. Go on therefore to use it, and let it rest no longer, till ye have perfected the service entrusted to you. Okay, so he viewed this, the courts of high commission as a sword to be used, and apparently hadn't used it enough in the past. So how did they use it? Well, they continued James's policy of persecuting and intimidating faithful ministers. I would say by this time, he probably gotten rid of most of the ones that were very sort of eloquent and outspoken. And now he was just on to ones that were maybe more just pious, but perhaps not as outspoken. Nevertheless, he summoned four reasonably well-known ministers, well-respected ones, or they were summoned before a court of high commission. And they, as we've seen in the past, they declined the jurisdiction of the court of high commission. And that, of course, is a major sin in and of itself in the eyes of the king and the high commission. So three of the four were banished to remote parts of the country, and the fourth was restricted to stay within the bounds of his parish. Also, let's see, Robert Bruce, who the minister that had been at one time one of James's ministers, and when James had gone to Denmark to get married, and he actually placed Robert Bruce on the Privy Council as an extraordinary member, and when he returned, he declared that Robert Bruce was his faithful and trusted counselor, that he was worth a fourth of his kingdom, so on. He was tossed into the castle of Edinburgh for seditious conduct, that is, preaching against the Articles of Perth. And then he was banished to Inverness and restricted to a four-mile radius around it. Now, one of the reasons for restricting him to this radius is so he wouldn't go off preaching circuitously in the countryside. Okay, let's see. Finally, this is just as a side note, Andrew Melville, who had been first spent 4 years in the Tower in prison under pretty miserable conditions, and then had been exiled to France and teaching theology in Sedan. He died in 1622, age 77. Okay, now James, from what I can tell, apparently imagined that most of his troubles with Puritanism in Scotland were due primarily to sort of rebellious ministers. By persecuting, removing, and/or intimidating them, he thought he could have his way. And this was true with respect to the church government. He largely succeeded in establishing episcopacy. But he couldn't so easily sway the populace. And I know a lot of our history that we've covered, you know, it's sort of been James and the elders and so on, and the ministers, and we haven't really talked as much about the congregation. The Articles of Perth in particular affected the individual congregations more so. A number of the congregations, particularly rural areas, didn't obey the Articles of Perth. They went on with their worship practice, which they believed to be biblical. In some of the larger congregations, they were forced to do this. This sometimes created three classes of members. Those who took communion kneeling, as ordered, those who took it seated, and those who refused to take it at all. So, in fact, in one particular parish in Burntisland, in the springs of 1617 and 1618 before... Oh, we have some more pronunciation experts here today. Mrs. Rees may appreciate. Simon occasionally will inform me if I'm mispronouncing something, so... It's spelled Burnt Island, but I don't know if that's how they say it or not. Let's see, in 1617, 1618, before the Articles of Perth were ratified by the General Assembly, the communion was attended by 900 people, and only 450 attended in 1619 and 425 in 1620. So that gives you some idea of sort of the division over this enforced worship practice. This is also the first mention I've seen in all the history I've been reading to date, first chronological case of what are known as private conventicles. This is where people meet outside the bounds of the church. This, of course, later becomes a much bigger issue during the persecution under Charles II and James II. But there were some private conventicles meeting in Edinburgh. When James found out about this, he threatened the local magistrates, as he's done before, with moving certain parts of the government away from Edinburgh. He threatened to move the courts of session and the justiciary. Okay, well, late winter and early spring of 1625, James's health failed very rapidly. And I know we've skipped over, you know, many, many details of James's reign. Again, I'd recommend to you this book by Otto Scott, as if you're interested, but we've skipped over most of what he's done in England, and so we get to his death rather quickly here. A day before he died, he suffered some kind of stroke, so that his tongue hung out, and he sort of gagged on a phlegm, and they kept bringing in towels and stuff. And then, as Otto Scott says, then God, a satirist whose scale is beyond all mortals, sent an attack of dysentery, and he died sort of in a very disgusting manner on the 27th of March, 1625, at age 58. I was trying to figure out how to summarize his life, and I'm going to actually sort of give it a review, but I thought I'd read Otto Scott's four-paragraph summary at the end. There was a one-sentence summary by another author that was pretty good. It said he wasn't a very good king, is about what it amounted to. I forget how he put it, but it was in one sentence, pretty pithy. So, okay, so some of this really we haven't covered, but I'll read it anyways. No fool was ever so fertile in the invention of fallacies or left behind so many enduring errors to plague the human race. His theory that peace can be purchased by cowardice helped move Europe into the 30 Years' War in his own day, and many more since. Hailed as a scholar, he sought to kill the thoughts of other men. Yet as he died in his filthy bed, the words of Buchanan were coursing through England's political underground, and the theories of Knox were creating a new church. James inherited a realm proud in the world, filled with riches, clear in purpose, and strong in its sense of destiny. He left it racked with dissension, economically gutted, sown thick with the seeds of revolution, sinking into incoherent wars. None of his descendants escaped the results of his follies. Prince Charles's Catholic marriage entangled all the Stuarts into eternal religious troubles with their English and Scots subjects. His attempt to continue the theories of Elizabeth and his mother, Mary Stuart, that sovereigns are above the law and created by divine sanction, led his son Charles I to the executioner's block and Louis XVI to the guillotine. Even the passage of centuries has not completely destroyed or extirpated the amazing virulence of James Stuart's arguments. Intellectuals still echo his desire to, quote, govern according to the common weal and not according to the common will. Governments still exist that believe, as did James in the Vatican of his day, that men can be held in mental prisons. And these arguments are still opposed by those who believe in Knox's living God and by those who agree with Buchanan that men cannot be governed without their own consent. Though the names of these men and their associates and the great tectonic revolution they launched are barely recalled. To the list of enduring errors, I should point out that the troubles in Northern Ireland had their roots when James settled a bunch of Scots on the Irish there, and to this day, the problems that exist there, which are very deep, they still exist. But he was the one who started it. So, okay, I'd like to now try to sort of quickly review James's life and his interactions with the church. The class is called A Tale of Two Kingdoms, A History of the Church of Scotland from the Reformation to the Glorious Revolution. Two kingdoms are the church, which has Christ as its king, and the state, which had James as its king. The story of James's life, in short, is that he wanted to be king over both state and the church. The church resisted this, although during the period of James's life he was more or less successful at establishing episcopacy, wresting the church's government away from the Presbyterian hierarchical government, the sort of bottom-up one that comes from elders being elected by the congregation, them representing the, the congregation, the presbytery, and the presbytery electing representatives to the synod, and the synod having representatives to the General Assembly. And he replaced it with sort of a top-down one, which he ran. So he appointed archbishops and bishops, and they appointed and deposed ministers. Okay, prior to the Reformation, right, the church in Scotland had been ruled by a corrupt church hierarchy. And interestingly enough, this was not all just appointed by the Pope. They had made, over time, various deals with nobles where the nobles would give land and then they would appoint various officers of the church. And those officers were often highly involved in politics and various kinds of corruption, as we detailed early in the class. So after the Reformation, the church had been ruled by the Presbyterian system, which I just described. So James's established episcopacy was partly an overthrow of the Reformation. Okay, but instead of having the power distributed among the nobles, it was concentrated on himself. So there was, if you want to think of it that way, a purely political dimension to this, in that when he established the bishops, he was able to have them be representatives in Parliament and actually diminish the powers of the nobles and gentry in the kingdom and increased his powers. Okay, but that leads to abuses, that's obvious, but it certainly fit in with his philosophy of being a true and free monarch, free of all controls. Okay, so to go over James's life, he had, skipping his birth and so on, even though those circumstances are very interesting, he had what was probably the best possible education. He was tutored by George Buchanan, who was certainly the foremost man of letters in Scotland, and he was also very well known and respected on the continent. James was incredibly bright. He was very much a child prodigy. At a young age, he impressed visitors with his knowledge of Greek, Hebrew, Latin, French, etc. He was extremely well-read and extremely well-taught. Buchanan realized that James had a perverse and rebellious nature. He dedicated a copy of his play, Baptistes, to James. The play's theme was tyranny. The dedication he wrote is, "This little book must seem to have a peculiar interest for yourself, inasmuch as it sets before you in the clearest manner what torments and miseries tyrants endure, even when most prosperous. And this lesson I deem not merely beneficial, but absolutely necessary for you. Moreover, I wish my book to be a standing witness to posterity that not with your teachers, but yourself rested the fault." Buchanan was very prescient with regards to his pupil, and this is indeed what happened. And while we might debate what went wrong with James's upbringing, one suspects that it might have had something to do with his guardian, or at least his guardian's wife, who didn't dare strike the Lord's anointed, the king. Those of you who were in the class will remember the little anecdote, which I won't repeat about that. Okay, but regardless of what really went wrong, it does sort of serve as a warning today that the best possible education, even a classical Christian one, when squandered on a young tyrant, may only end up aiding him in his tyranny. That's what it did. Also, James became and remained throughout his life incredibly arrogant. And his arrogance took the form that he thought he could argue successfully with anyone. And if anyone didn't agree with him, it was obvious to James that he was right, and that the other party was wrong, but could be persuaded by his brilliant logic. Somebody might have some other different beliefs, didn't fit with his worldview. Okay, James, perhaps because of the way he was brought up, was easily manipulated by others who were willing to flatter him. And this was first manifest to the world when his older cousin, Esme Stuart, the Seigneur d'Aubigné, came to town in 1579, bringing a lot of presents for James and sort of swept James off his feet. James left the tutelage of Buchanan and surrounded himself with bad counselors, so Esme Stuart and other ones, perhaps even worse. But one question that came up in class again and again, partly related to this, was why did James go in the direction that he did? And if he had cooperated with the church, it seems likely that he would have had a very successful reign. I think this is true, but of course it might also be said that if Pharaoh had just let the Israelites go, he might have had a very successful reign. It's been said, although I don't know that it's been proven, that Esme Stuart filled James's heads with stories of how James's relatives in France maintained power over the church and the people by use of bishops that were controlled by the Duke of Guise. Right, in fact, the Duke of Guise's brother was the Cardinal of Lorraine, and they exercised quite ruthless power even over the king through this whole system. So I was thinking about a little bit, because this is a question really that hasn't been answered, you know, where did these ideas come from? In thinking about it, I picked up a book that was published in 1513. This copy was printed a lot later, of course. This is The Prince by Machiavelli. I should make this clear. I'm not reading this as an example of what we ought to do. This is an example of how the enemy thinks, okay? So just a couple of brief quotes. Likening a king to various animals and how he might behave, he recommends being wily like a fox. And he says, but it is necessary to know well, this is for the prince, how to disguise this characteristic, and to be a great pretender and dissembler. And men are so simple and so subject to present necessities that he who seeks to deceive will always find someone who will allow himself to be deceived. Okay, and then carrying on later, talking about how the king, whatever else he actually does, he should always make everything sound like he has faith, friendship, humanity, and religion. For this reason, a prince ought to take care that he never lets anything slip from his lips that is not replete with the above-named five qualities, that he may appear to him who sees and hears him altogether merciful, faithful, humane, upright, and religious. There is nothing more necessary to appear to have than this last quality, inasmuch as men judge generally more by the eye than by the hand, because it belongs to everybody to see you, to few to come in touch with you. Everyone who sees what you appear to be, few really know what you are, and those few dare not oppose themselves to the opinion of the many, who have the majesty of the state to defend them, and in the actions of all men, and especially princes, which it is not prudent to challenge, one judges by the result. Mike.
Does that mean that politicians and things like that should on Sunday be carrying a Bible?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. The most important quality is to appear to be religious. Now, I'm not saying that necessarily James only got this from Machiavelli, or you know that. I would guess that he had read Machiavelli. I mean, James is extremely widely read, and certainly for a king, this would be an important book to read. But if you see, like when we looked at these various acts and so on, and we read them, they all sound very pious. Where do you get the ideas from? I don't know for sure, but they didn't originate with James. Okay? And they didn't end with James either, did they, Mike? Okay, well, James was very proud of his so-called kingcraft. That's what he called it. Now, craft, of course, also meant like lying and dissembling. This was his way of ruling, or you could say fleecing the people. Okay, one early example, in my opinion, although I can't prove this absolutely, was this: the King's Confession of 1581. There was an ongoing Catholic scare in the country. These things occurred from time to time. Just to give you an idea, the scare was probably based on, first of all, Esme Stuart was definitely an agent of the Duke of Guise and probably of the Pope. There were a number of French visitors in Edinburgh, and one would guess that they probably invoked memories of the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre. There were certainly a lot of Jesuit priests traveling throughout the English countryside. There were rumors of assassination plots against Elizabeth and invasion plots against Scotland. And in fact, these rumors were not all false. There were actually very serious sort of invasion plots going on. When this happened, I forget how one writer puts it, but essentially thought that James's indiscretions, his homosexuality, was being maybe become more widely known at this time. He came up with this idea of a confession or covenant to be written up and for him to sign. It was sort of, if you read it, it was sort of a touchstone to clearly separate Protestants from false Protestants, true Protestants from false Protestants or secret Catholics. And in fact, there had been a letter discovered, a dispensation from the Pope, which allowed Catholics to pretend they were Protestants as long as they were really working for the reconversion of the country to Catholicism. And so all these things together, of course, made this big Catholic scare. And as I mentioned when I covered this in April, it's hard, maybe with 21st century eyes here, it's hard to see it as anything but a public relations ploy. And maybe it was more than that, but James was to use this sort of ploy throughout his life, not necessarily signing a covenant, but giving some sort of flowery speech to the General Assembly full of promises to reform himself, statements of how great the Church of Scotland was. In fact, there was one where he said specifically that this was the best church in all the world, and these other churches celebrated Easter and Christmas, and what have they for that but a tradition of man? And then, of course, later, one of the things in the Acts of Perth that he forced on the church was celebration of Easter and Christmas, Ascension, Good Friday, and so on. He later forced that on the church. Okay, the promises that he made were patently false. So, it's probably impossible to prove that he didn't mean it at the time he said it. James spent about 10 months of his adolescence under the control of some lords who resented Esme Stuart and James's other bad counselors. So we've seen this a number of times where sort of one government replaces another one in a forcible manner rather than a democratic one. They basically kicked Esme Stuart out. And at least one historian believes that James probably honed his skills at dissimulation or lying during his captivity. And you might date from that period sort of the time when James becomes increasingly at odds with the church. The lords of the enterprise, as they were known, asked for the church's approval, and they got some sort of approval. And when James escaped, his resentment of the church seemed to increase. I mean, I don't think that he liked Puritans before that, but it seems to have been an escalation from then on. Okay, his resentment and irritation worked itself out in several ways. He took revenge on those who had approved of his new government. He banished the preacher John Dury, who we cannot forget as being described as walking with his hag butt out in the country searching for small game. He was banished from Edinburgh. Andrew Melville was hauled before the Privy Council in the March of 1584 on somewhat specious charges. He declined the authority of the Privy Council. Right? This is this idea of declinature. This becomes an important theme and perhaps the central one in the conflict between the two kingdoms. Okay, to review, the church's and Melville's claim with regards to the authority of the Privy Council was not an absolute claim of independence from the authority of the civil magistrate. Rather, it was a claim that in all ordinary cases, the church had the right to first try any ministers for the content of their sermons. It wasn't a claim of absolute immunity, which had been made by the Catholic Church, but with multiple controlling authorities, okay, the minister being a subject of one kingdom and, as it were, an ambassador of the other, it was necessary that there be some protocol for handling the claims of both kingdoms. And this didn't preclude the minister from being tried by the civil magistrate for seditious or treasonous preaching. But this really inflamed James. Every time a declinature was made, it was considered treasonous. And of course, if you're trying to be sort of the king and the pope, as it were, of the England and Scotland, then when someone declines your authority, obviously they're directly rebelling against you. From this time forward, there was almost a continuous battle between the two kingdoms. Okay, we've often referred to this as the battle for prerogative. James attempted to assert his prerogative over the church. There were some periods when relations improved slightly, but even then, if you read carefully, it looks like James was sticking to his plan. He tried to gain more and more control of the church. Okay, as we've seen, there was some pattern to this, and I don't mean every incident followed the exact same pattern, but basically, there was often some instigation on the king's part, a new proposal, a new act, a new something, right? And then he would attempt to force the ministers to somehow swear compliance or act on this. And when they refused, he would persecute, intimidate, exile the ministers who wouldn't comply. Then perhaps he would maybe persecute the most prominent examples, and then perhaps some small compromise might be made on his part. Put the term compromise in quotes, a clause that he could ignore or a promise that he might make and then later forget. And this might allow the rest of the ministers to agree. If the persecution was sufficient, particularly if he could remove enough ministers, then his task was that much easier the next time around. Okay, in 1584, the Parliament passed the so-called Black Acts. This was done highly secretively, essentially by the king, but he got the parliament to ratify it. It had confirmed his authority over all estates and persons, in other words, over both kingdoms. It legally reestablished the bishops as one of the three estates that made up parliament, and made it a crime to speak or preach against this. Also forbade the church to assemble without the king's permission, convoking the king's lieges, in other words, assembling without permission. A number of ministers protested the Black Acts. Some were forced to flee the countries. Others were in prison. One was condemned to death for, quote, corresponding with rebels. He wasn't executed, but for several weeks he had to look out his prison cell window to see a specially fabricated gallows there. The remaining ministers were called in and threatened by the Earl of Arran, one of the king's counselors. And that failing, the Archbishop of St. Andrews came up with a compromise. Okay, this is just a species here of what I talked about earlier. The addition of a phrase, as McCree says, one of those ambiguous and unmeaning clauses which serve only to blind the simple and to salve the consciences of such as are anxious to escape from trouble. And the phrase was, according to the word of God, so they were supposed to obey the bishops according to the word of God. James Melville said this was as if one should say he would obey the Pope and his prelates according to the word of God. Okay, nevertheless, a number of ministers fell for it and signed a bond by which they approved of the Black Acts. After James was married, I mentioned this earlier about Robert Bruce, he came back, everything was good in the kingdom, and enjoyed actually a remarkable period of peace while he was gone. Maybe that's not coincidental. But he was in a slightly better mood, and the church was given some official standing in the so-called Golden Act, and this was in 1592. It approved meetings of Kirk Sessions, Presbyteries, Synods, and General Assemblies, and it softened some provisions of the Black Acts. But if you read this act carefully, even within it, there are all the sort of catches and clauses that allow him to later take control of the church. So one of them is that becomes very important is the scheduling of the General Assembly. He was allowed to schedule a General Assembly unless neither he nor his representative were present, in which case the church could do it. Later on, he forgot that part of the clause and just said it was only up to him, and if he didn't schedule it, it could just be postponed forever. Okay, within a few years, though, this battle for prerogative heated up again, and on the, 9th of November 1596, a commission of the church was told by the king that there could be no agreement between them unless they agreed to the following points. They wouldn't discuss matters of state in their sermons. The General Assembly shouldn't meet without his command. That nothing the General Assembly did should be valid until he had ratified it, as he ratified Acts of Parliament. Again, that's adding sort of his, increasing his dominion over the church. And that the church shouldn't bother itself disciplining any offense punishable by the criminal law. Okay, and the church historically had to discipline, not with the sword, but with excommunication, people who are guilty of grievous sins that should have been punished by the civil law but weren't. Okay, so this was immediately followed up by trying an outspoken minister, David Black, for supposedly preaching seditious sermons. And then later in the year, James found the event he was looking for, and this is a certainly recognize this from modern politics. There was a little non-event where there was some excitement in town and people ran around for about an hour. No one was hurt. There was a threat of revolution and people were running around to try to quell it. Well, James called this, turned this in sort of a media event, a very serious treasonous uprising. Made all kinds of threats against Edinburgh and against the church. And once he had the people sort of suitably cowed, he rigged the vote in the General Assembly by bringing in a bunch of northern ministers who had not generally been able to attend the assembly. They were flattered, they were bribed, and he got them to agree to create a committee of advisors for the king. Okay, now this sounds harmless enough. What could be more harmless than a committee of advisors to help tell the king what to do? Well, over the next 14 years, this committee was first in 1598 granted a vote in Parliament. Okay, it wasn't called, they weren't called bishops yet, but they were granted a vote in Parliament. And this was approved by the General Assembly, again, with a lot of politicking. 1600, they were granted a lifetime appointment. Well, actually, the General Assembly voted against giving them a lifetime appointment, voted to give them an annual appointment, which would be keep them under some more control. But the king had the clerk reword the measure so that it came out the other way. At some point in here, they started to call the men bishops. In the same year, he started appointing men to vacant bishoprics without the consent of the church. That was one of the terms they had agreed to previously. In 1606, the bishops were given large estates, previously had been seized by the crown. They were given more or less the status they had before the Reformation. By this time, James no longer allowed the churches to elect representatives to the General Assembly through a series of steps, one of which was they would give him six names and he would pick one to represent them, to eventually him just giving them a list of representatives. It got to the point where he just controlled who the representatives of the General Assembly were. In December of 1606, the General Assembly, this hand-picked General Assembly, approved the bishops to be constant, what were known as constant moderators. Okay, in our church, a moderator is elected once each year to serve for the next year. The moderator does run the meeting, but to keep order. But of course, if you're only elected for a year, it's a bit hard to build up a huge power structure. In 1609, they were given the power to set all minister salaries, and they used that power to reward the ones that were compliant, to abuse the ones that weren't. And in 1610, in the so-called Angelical Assembly, called Angelical because an angel was on the coin that was used to bribe the ministers with, the bishops were given a number of additional powers, which essentially completed the overthrow of Presbyterian church government. I mean, it was pretty much overthrown at this point, and represented the complete establishment of episcopacy controlled by the king. That's a quick summary of 14 years. Interspersed in there were a number of occasions where they either harassed, arrested, banished, etc., the more outspoken ministers, including Andrew Melville and a number of other ministers. And also the elevation, bribery, and flattery of those who were more compliant and willing to go along. Okay, so what lessons might we draw from this for today? I have five. Those of you in the class, I've probably heard most of these before. So first of all, despite what the public school lobby says, a great education does not necessarily guarantee a great outcome. And this is also true of Christian education. I mean, it doesn't guarantee a great outcome. As we might expect, a church that follows Christ truly can be expected to incur the hostility of the world. Third, Christians are naturally gullible, to use Mike's words. Time and time again, they were, I think as I meant when I read Machiavelli, you saw this, people who want to be deceived can be deceived. Maybe why do they want to be deceived? Well, if they're deceived, then life is a lot easier, right? They don't have to take a stand. This characteristic was exploited in the struggle between the two kingdoms, and I hope and believe that studying church history is an antidote to this, so that's a reason why we should study church history. Internal corruption in church is a great danger. James used a two-pronged attack on the church to gain control over it. He attacked from the outside by persecuting and exiling faithful and effective ministers, and he attacked from the inside by corrupting ministers with the promise of riches, or at least coins. I don't know that that meant... Some got rich. The bishops got very rich. I don't know that all those northern ministers got rich, but they at least got some coins. And also by flattering their baser instincts. So one of his appeals to the northern ministers was that these the men of the south, who had been much more active in the assembly, were sort of appointing themselves as popes of the church and all this kind of stuff to invoke envy. Finally, fifth, even James, in a sense, was forced to acknowledge the central claim of Presbyterian church government. In other words, that the church is ruled by Christ, and it's ruled through the church, not by the civil government. All of the destructive acts and changes originated within the church. They were later ratified by the Privy Council and by Parliament, but once basically got its wedge in there and started pushing things, everything originated within the church, all the problems. I've skipped over mostly the five articles of Perth, which is where James begins an attempt at transforming the Scottish church into an Anglican one. And we'll stop there and take questions. Mike? Okay, Dan.
Well, my comment was, a parallel to this would be is if President Clinton takes that commission of the Bible, King James was such a predator that he used the church for his own ends, all these other things, that maybe 100 years from now we're going to have President
Obama. Well, as bright as our president might be, I really doubt if he knows Greek and Hebrew and Latin. So, but Dan.
Well, I am just a question about incrementalism. This is seems yeah. the way that James took the church down, basically, just piece by piece, a little bit. He had a plan in mind, and he worked the plan very well. And in the church, of course, we reject that completely out of hand. I mean, that's we want to go straight to the end, the absolute truth. We don't incrementally try to move the church towards truth. If we are convinced that something is true, we want to go all the way there. So the question is, are we right, Christians? Are Christians right in insisting that Christian politicians reject incrementalism out of hand? And I guess I don't have an answer for this, but incrementalism works as a political method.
Just look at the gun control lobby.
Well, that's right. But Christians all seem to reject that as a method for their own people. I mean, take the abortion fight, if you will. Whenever a bill comes up that incrementally takes abortion rights apart, there's a huge split every time among conservative ranks. And it's with basically the incrementalists saying, well, we're getting a little bit, let's keep going. And everybody else saying, no, it's absolutely true. We can't do this. We've got to go all the way. And I wonder if anybody has any comments on that or any thoughts on that as to whether or not that's a viable, whether or not that is a godly way for, whether incrementalism is a godly way for a statesman to pursue his craft or not.
Henry, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah. One thing about you know that truth be a problem is not being the people, some people who are the folks might approach a little step to the medical for a big step, but they might not go all the way by little steps. You might get some people just for doing the one whole thing, but you might not get people to do it little step by little step.
It's been said that politics is the art of the possible. Vicki, you want to?
And then William Wilberforce probably used that to abolish slavery in England.
It was abolished much more peaceably than here. Dave.
I haven't kept up to date with all of what you said with James and Christine Lester, but was he a very wealthy man during those early years in Scotland?
No, in Scotland he thought of himself as very poor. I mean, I certainly wasn't poor, in poverty, but he didn't have the sort of wealth that he would have liked. And the reason, you notice that, let's see, Otto Scott said he left the country with a lot of debt. Well, he was definitely not a money manager. He gave away huge amounts of money to his favorites. And one time one of his counselors put all the money he was granting to somebody in a pile in a room and made him come look at it. He got mad and changed the amount. So. Okay. Henry.
I think mostly step by step is really inspiration. You have to look at the whole picture to see which method would be best.
Yeah. I think you could argue in this country, Dan, that the pro-life movement is partly accepted incrementalism, and that's why we're seeing all these bills against partial birth abortion. It's very hard for people to argue against that. Although, as you see, the Clintons and the women's rights groups and so on clearly see they're not so gullible. They see incrementalism for what it is. You know, that's why. I mean, I think they're hard pressed to argue that in and of itself, it's that bad. But they, you know, they realize that it's an incremental attack. So.
It seems like that's a one way for Christians to go on the offensive, rather than always staking out the high ground and say all or nothing.
Yeah, well, in a sort of a backward sense, it could have the same advantage that James had, right? James would put something out on the table, find out who was opposed to it, and then get rid of him. Christians can do sort of the opposite by putting it out on the table and then finding out who the sort of the worst enemies are and unelecting them, or not re-electing them. So. I guess the fundamental difference is the sort of form of government, right? If you're a king, you have a lot more power to change things, right? I think it's a confession that mentions according to our place and station, right? And if you're an elected member of a republic, you don't have the same sort of power that a monarch might have.
Yeah.
Or should I say monarchs used to have? I don't know. So, but I guess that other question on incrementalism would be if you change something and then you don't keep on with the task, I guess that eventually will come back to haunt you. So. Okay, well, thanks for your time. Dave, would you close in prayer?